Another hello to our podcast listeners. You've probably heard us talk about our social networking site, MyCity. Well, we've added some new features to the site, including a widget for my Twitter stream and an embeddable Smart City audio player so you can add us to your blog or website. If you're not a member of Smart City, send an email to Scotty, the producer of Smart City, and he'll get you set up. The address is scotty@smartcityradio.com. I look forward to seeing you on the site, and now, on with the show. I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. How do you reinvigorate the economy of a Rust Belt city? Our guests on this week's show are working both at the grassroots and at the civic level to rebuild the economies of their mid-sized cities. Ron Kitchen is the CEO of Southwest Michigan First, a nonprofit organization dedicated to being the catalyst for success in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Ron joins us to tell us about incubating new companies in this economy and how smaller businesses can thrive when larger corporations fail. Eric Matthews is the founder of Launch Memphis, which welcomes and nurtures technology startups in Memphis. We'll talk to Eric about how technology can help seed an entrepreneurial community and be used to bring entrepreneurs together. Stick around for Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. As America transitions from a manufacturing economy to an economy of ideas, many cities in the Rust Belt found their companies fleeing. But the city of Kalamazoo, Michigan wasn't content with that reality and began incubating new companies with the help of my first guest, Ron Kitchens. Ron is the CEO of Southwest Michigan First, a nonprofit in Kalamazoo that serves to connect people, information, and resources to build the future entrepreneurs of Kalamazoo. Ron, where do you begin to rebuild a Rust Belt economy?
Well, I think for us, we went back to basics and looked at what are the things that we've always been great at. And for us, it isn't particular industries. It's we've always been great at building businesses. So in our community, we've been number one in the world in celery manufacturing and sleds and stoves and guitars and rods and reels and women's corsets. Not to mention, this is the place that literally the pill was invented, the orthopedic surgical industry. But all of those things have a cycle. And so, most of that's not here anymore. But we've built 60 or 70 new companies in the last 5 or 6 years. And that's our future, is entrepreneurial growth. Really, it's about the mind economy and not the brawn economy.
Tell me what it takes to build businesses. You say that's in the culture there. So break it down for me. What are those qualities that help a city like Kalamazoo and Southwest Michigan understand how to build businesses?
I think it's the fact that we build a support network. So we don't just find entrepreneurs and say, good luck. It's we build a support system around them, whether it's our incubator, which was the National Incubator of the Year last year, whether it's a venture fund and putting capital around companies, it's mentoring. It's knowing that when companies come to us and we're taking that idea and that entrepreneur, we're going to help them move forward as a team. Much the way a large corporation would move an idea forward, we're just doing it on a community-wide basis. And we have an understanding that everybody in the process is taking a risk. And we accept that there are going to be some failures and there are going to be some success, and know that when the failures happen, we shrug our shoulders, learn the lesson, and move forward.
Tell me about the recent trajectory of Kalamazoo's economic decline and now resurgence.
We saw in 1999 General Motors close stamping plant here, 4,000 jobs. We saw 6 paper plants close. Kalamazoo literally was the paper capital of certainly the United States, one of the finest paper centers in the world. We also saw the Upjohn Company be purchased, which is now Pfizer, and we lost 4,000 jobs in both research and office management from that. We saw what a lot of communities would have faced and just shrugged their shoulders and collapsed. And we've seen communities in bankruptcy all over America from less. But this community really made the decision that we're going to build on our history. So the day that, Pfizer announced that they were going to do away with 2,000 research jobs, we were a week away from opening our incubator. We've now incubated, you know, nearly 30 companies through that facility, creating thousands of jobs. We've actually replaced every life science job we lost. We've now replaced, but instead of having one large company in this region, we now have 200 life science companies from those we've built and those we've recruited here to take advantage of our 100-year legacy. You know, the paper mill industry, where everybody told us it was gone, that paper and cardboard production were really moving offshore. We've now seen in the last 3 years two major projects come to this community, but they're more based around the technology because of the research we have at Western Michigan University. So we've been able to build upon that. Just last year, we announced 6,000 new jobs in this community, the largest life science announcement of the year, with 3,300 new jobs at one company alone. So we've been able to do that because we've built upon what our past history is, and that's entrepreneurialism and not trying to be the nano anything or be the next wind technology community. We've been who we always are.
I love your story, Ron. You tell it well. Let me ask you this. You mentioned the mix of growing businesses and recruiting businesses. Talk to me a little bit about that mix from an economic development standpoint, someone who runs Southwest Michigan First, and you look at the region, where do you spend most of your time? Where is your best investment made in working with locals versus trying to recruit companies to the community?
We put 50% of our resources into the creation of new companies. As I mentioned, our incubator, the Southwest Michigan Innovation Center, we have the only community-based true venture fund in the nation. We raised $50 million locally for a true venture fund that has a dual bottom line that says, if you want our money, you got to move to our community. And then the creation and business development of companies. The other 50% of our resources are really spent divided equally, and not really equally. Of that 50%, probably two-thirds of that is spent on existing companies and building and expanding them, and helping them grow and develop new product lines, access resources that they never knew existed. And then the rest is really about the recruitment, which a lot of times gets the headlines, but it's those other areas that are going to be our long-term strategy and produce long-term growth.
Tell me what you do to help existing businesses.
My staff and I will make in excess of 800 visits this year with about 200 existing companies. And we're doing everything from working with them on talent recruitment, spousal relocation, accessing government programs, procurement. I met with a large international company this morning with the whole goal of asking them to use our local companies as suppliers. So we're networking companies together. We're working on financing. You know, right now it's a tough time to access capital. So we've brought together a group of entrepreneurial bankers and said, we want you to become, you know, we call them the Bank Consortium for Innovation. And I know bankers and innovation don't normally get talked about in the same sentence. But in this case, these bankers have come together and said, we want to do deals with existing companies that aren't traditional banking opportunities. We'll figure out a way to get it done, even if we have to share the loans, but we want to grow our companies. We can only do that if we all work together and amalgamate those resources.
In terms of talent recruitment to Michigan First and Kalamazoo Second, how do you do that?
We're blessed with a number of very high-quality companies who are recruiting top talent around the nation. And we work closely with them because one of the issues they have is trailing spouse employment. So by bringing companies together to marry their really enlightened self-interest, they're able to not only recruit their staff, but they're able to bring top talent in that benefits other companies. We also have a consortium of companies, we're over 30 now, that are talent-based and talent-driven. And so they meet on a regular basis, not only to share best practices around recruiting and engaging talent, but to also cooperate on programs like our internship program, which takes, you know, we have 45,000 college students in this community. We know the number one reason they're going to stay in this community is they've got a job or they have access to employment. So we've been able to engage those employers around programs. So our interns not only work a summer intern, but they also receive a $6,000 college scholarship for working that internship on top of the pay they receive. We've been able to do that, as we like to say, because of an enlightened self-interest that we know that talent is the most important commodity we have in this community.
You said they receive a $6,000 scholarship in addition to the job and the pay for the job. Is that provided by the companies?
That's provided by a foundation by the name of the Monroe Brown Foundation. They were their family foundation that's always supported education. But rather than just do general scholarships, they've really made the decision they want to invest in building capacity. And we know that it builds capacity. About 50% of the people who go through the program are hired permanently after graduation, which is three or four times the normal number.
Wow. Lou Glazer at Michigan Future, I know you know Lou, says that one of the problems in Michigan is a culture that doesn't value college, a culture that says, get a high school education and you'll get a good job for life and be able to retire at age 55. Is that a problem in Kalamazoo?
It would be foolish for me to say no. We're somewhat different because of the large number of college students we have in this community, thus the large number of college graduates, both educators and professional, who are here with Western Michigan University, Kalamazoo College, which is one of the nation's premier liberal arts schools, and then Kalamazoo Valley Community College. This community values education, I think, above all else. You know, we're the home to the Kalamazoo Promise, the nation's first program that said, if you graduate from the public school system, we'll pay for you to go to college 4 years to any public college or university in the state, whether you're number one in your class or whether you're dead last. You graduate, any school you can get into, we'll pay for. And that really is indicative of our commitment to education, because that's the value system that we're based on. That's where we're going to deliver for the future.
Now, I want to talk about the Kalamazoo Promise, because it's not unusual at all for me to be out visiting in communities, as I was earlier this week, and have someone mention the Kalamazoo Promise. They admire it. They want to copy it. Has the promise been in place long enough now that students are, in fact, taking advantage of the promise and using the scholarship dollars?
We're in our third year of college students, so school's just about finished here at Western, another month or so, a couple of weeks, I guess. Students will start next year as seniors. So this time next year, we'll have our first four-year graduating class, and they're doing tremendous. We're seeing not only our college attendance numbers go up dramatically, but we have 1,400 new children in the school system. Now, we're in Michigan, and you don't see a lot of school systems with new children in the districts. We have 1,400 new kids in the districts. We're building three new schools. We have a couple hundred new teachers in our school system, all as a direct result of this program. And our dropout rate was cut by 50%. It's a major epidemic in this nation of students dropping out of schools, and we're cutting it by 50% because now they believe they have a future. And that means a lot.
And you feel confident that dropout numbers are so suspect and they're calculated in different ways in different places. You feel good that that's a real number?
Absolutely. And anybody can verify that. If you go to the Upjohn Institute, it's Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. They're an independent think tank that has been contracted to maintain, manage, and monitor all of the statistics and demographics of the program. And so they're verifying every number, and it's on their website in real time.
Interesting. When a city suffers job losses, as you did dramatically in 1999, how do you strike a balance, Ron, between grieving the loss and moving forwards? In other words, I guess it's a question of how do you fake it till you make it?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, because it's easy to start looking for blame and who are we going to blame for this and who's responsible for our problem and who's going to bail us out. And I get a lot of calls these days from communities that say, you know, we've just lost a GM plant. What do we do? And I don't mean to be trite or insensitive when I tell them, but my response is buy some bootstraps. There's only one way you're going to get out of this, and you're going to pull yourself out of it. It's rare that a company leaves a community or these negative things happen that you didn't know it was going to happen. And so when it happened, really, I tell you right now, if a few years ago we had a Pfizer had made an additional announcement of some shuffling of jobs in it, a couple hundred jobs lost in this community. And I looked at the vice chairman of my board, Bill Parfit, whose grandfather was Dr. Upjohn. And Bill looked over next to me and said, well, thank God, we knew that was going to happen. It's not hanging over our head anymore. Now we can move forward. And that's really what makes this community different. You know, we were the place that Checker Cab, we're the home of Checker Cab. When was the last time you rode in one of those? Gibson guitar. When was the last time you played one made in Kalamazoo or Shakespeare rod and reel? We're the place, we have to understand all businesses have cycles. And it's our responsibility as economic leaders to make sure people are prepared to grieve a little bit. And we don't want to understate those folks who, you know, are unemployed now. It's painful and it hurts and the families are scared and bills keep coming. But when we're growing an economy, we have to move forward, because the only other thing that can happen if we don't is irrelevancy and death. And that is a bigger crime than being a little insensitive.
What are the biggest hurdles to creating a vibrant economy in Kalamazoo that you face?
Capital. There are more ideas for Michigan ranks very near the top of idea formulation. We have some incredible research institutions in this state, whether it's the University of Michigan or Michigan State or Western or the 15 other state schools. We have incredible industrial idea formulation. But when we look at capital formulation, those dollars are still going to the East and West Coast. And so we're working every day to generate capital to the point that we went out and created, you know, our own venture fund and raised $50 million. And it's a traditional for-profit venture fund because we simply couldn't get those capital dollars into the community.
Do you operate that fund?
I do. I serve as the general partner.
Are you focused on particular industries or are you very broad?
We're focused on life science for us, and we define that as the bio side of it, so the pharmaceutical industry, contract research organizations, medical device, and we do a little food science in there.
Mm-hmm. How does the word spread that you have capital to invest?
We spend a lot of time on the road talking to entrepreneurs, and one will tell the other one. We attend a lot of investment strategy opportunities, so we're meeting hundreds of companies a year. I tell you, before the economic slowdown, it was pretty difficult to get the word out. But as dollars got harder to find on the East and West Coast, we're getting a lot more calls as people are really saying, you know, I'll move to Michigan if I can get dollars to continue my dream of building a great company.
Mm-hmm. Besides the dollars, do people wonder what would living in Kalamazoo, Michigan be like? Do you have to make a sales pitch there?
I usually do, and I'm not from Michigan. I grew up in the Missouri Ozarks, and before I got here, I was living on the Gulf of Mexico in Corpus Christi. And when I was recruited to come here by the chairman of my board, who grew up in Chicago and came here to go to college, he said, "You don't understand, Kalamazoo, we're different than the rest of the state." Well, I'd been to Michigan every February to go to the Detroit Auto Parts Show, and I wasn't interested. But they convinced me to come and look. And, you know, when I tell people now what it's like, I get to travel all over the country, I'll put Kalamazoo culturally, socially up against Austin, Texas, and Boise, Idaho every day of the week. We've got an incredible arts community. We have a vibrant social community. We are one of the best business communities I've ever seen, but we're also one of the most liberal social communities I've ever seen, and a real sense of commitment and sharing. So it is a vibrant place. Now, everybody asks about winter. Yeah, it snows here. And my daughter went from surfing on the weekends to snow skiing on the weekends. You know, my life isn't controlled by the phases of the moon or the weather outside.
I think Michigan is actually beautiful, and I think you're absolutely right. People, I don't know, maybe we're all obsessed with weather these days, but I think people grossly overplay the worries about cold weather and snow. I kind of like the four seasons myself. Let me ask you this. Ron, you've done so much right. What mistakes have you made that you think you, looking back on it, you could have avoided?
Gosh, we have a phenomenal board of directors, kind of keeps us from making a lot of really big mistakes. I think we probably have not gone fast enough and hard enough. Nobody can anticipate the recession we're in now. I would have liked to have had 10 or 15 more startup companies under our belt as we went into this, because it's a great time to grow. Our small companies are growing and thriving because the big companies are looking how they can outsource and offsource things. And we're in a growth mode. And I think we had 15 or 20 more. So I guess if I had anything to do, we'd have worked harder and created more.
What are the lessons you've learned in Kalamazoo that can help other cities in economic distress?
I think for us, it's been focus on education. You got to have bright, talented people, and you got to keep them in the community. You've got to have capital, and it doesn't mean $50 million. I think Kauffman Institute in Kansas City tells us that, you know, the average successful startup starts up with $25,000, but you got to have capital for them to start. You know, you really got to have a community that embraces and understands what it means to start companies and is supportive of that. And there's clusters of those communities all over America. And then I really think, you know, we've got to build the resources for the future. Too many times we think of infrastructure as streets and airports and sewer and water lines. And the real infrastructure of the future are business incubators and recording studios and those capacity building things that allow people to come together to collaborate to build multiple businesses within that same infrastructure. And those that do that, those are going to succeed in the future.
Ron, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, glad to be here.
Ron Kitchens is the CEO of Southwest Michigan First, a nonprofit in Kalamazoo, Michigan, dedicated to being the economic catalyst for the Southwest Michigan region. To find out more about Ron's work and to check out the book he wrote on the subject, head to our website, smartcityradio.com. Now, for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
The recession, it seems, is pulling people together. A recent article from the Washington Post looks at a trend of increasing public participation in community activities. Vacant homes are turning out to have a silver lining in some communities, as concerns over security have neighbors banding together for neighborhood watch groups and other similar activities. The result is better communication and interaction between neighbors. Some scholars and sociologists are saying this trend of, quote, neighboring is an unexpected boon for civic engagement. Historically, during the Great Depression, for example, tough times can slow community participation. But researchers think this recession-fueled uptick could finally bring about a revival of civic engagement not seen since the 1960s. Meanwhile, some neighbors in Northern California are pulling together for another cause, suing the state of California's High-Speed Rail Authority. The cities of Menlo Park and Atherton have filed suit challenging the chosen route of California's high-speed rail project connecting Northern and Southern California. Menlo Park and Atherton are getting cold feet about the route running through their neighborhood and want the line moved. According to an article in the San Francisco Chronicle, a successful ruling in the lawsuit could delay the project by 2 to 3 years and add millions to the price tag. Despite those delays, the plaintiff cities are standing strong in their opposition. Unless the train is rerouted, opponents say, it will cut a deep scar across their communities, and that's a scar they'd rather have someone else suffer. And finally, out in London, Mayor Boris Johnson recently announced an ambitious plan to build a new bridge over the Thames. But it's not your ordinary bridge. Johnson wants it to include shops, housing, and twin high-rise towers. The Evening Standard reported recently on the plan, which is actually an idea put forward back in the 1990s. Plans were dropped later in the decade, but Johnson is set on putting them back into motion. The Living Bridge would be similar to Florence's Ponte Vecchio Bridge, which also holds buildings. And though the idea seems futuristic, it wouldn't be the first time a bridge was more than a bridge in London. The iconic London Bridge originally had buildings and commercial properties, but they were torn down almost 200 years ago. As far as a timeline for this new bridge is concerned, the plan is mainly in the idea stage. Though the design has been completed, Johnson still has the task of convincing Londoners and local officials that the $120 million project is worth the effort. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, Eric Matthews of Launch Memphis joins us to tell us about bringing technology startups to Memphis and why entrepreneurs should be paying it forward. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The big success stories in Memphis have been FedEx and AutoZone, but my next guest, Eric Matthews, is looking to add to that list. He's the co-founder of Launch Memphis, an organization dedicated to nurturing technology startups. Eric is a successful entrepreneur in his own right, and he's using Launch Memphis as a way to give back to his community. Eric, many cities have rediscovered the importance of fueling the local entrepreneurial economy, especially now. You've been working to do that with Launch Memphis. Tell me about Launch Memphis.
Launch Memphis was an organization created by entrepreneurs here locally to support entrepreneurial action. We wanted to provide connectivity to entrepreneurs and to capital, provide dynamic programming to get them thinking creatively about new innovative ideas. And we also wanted to provide training and skill sets around entrepreneurship. And so we started out in 2008. And since then, we've created an economic impact of over $500,000 for the city.
Well, I want to ask you about several things you've just said. First of all, tell me about the skill set that is needed to be a successful entrepreneur.
Entrepreneurs need to have just general business function, back-end skills regarding accounting and financing and things like that. Beyond that, there are some other skills like being able to leverage social connectivity and networks, being able to amass knowledge around a topic area, identify ideas, and then eventually being able to execute successfully. As individuals, they can do so with their very highly motivated entrepreneurs, but in many communities, having support networks to help them move forward faster helps support economic vibrance in the community.
Now, you are focused particularly on technology startups. Are tech startups significantly different from other startups?
You know, business fundamentals are business fundamentals. I think the main difference why communities do focus in on them is for their high impact regarding their economic growth and job growth, looking to create gazelles in the community that have, you know, 20% annual growth. That's really why people focus in on those, and that's the most efficient use of time and dollars for community leaders if they're going to try to amass that, especially around areas of interest and a particular focus for their communities and technology.
Well, if I look at AutoZone, one of the businesses Fortune magazine recently featured as doing well in this terrible economy, or FedEx, which of course pretty much follows the economy but has had enormous growth and provided 20,000 plus jobs in Memphis. They've been very important contributors to the local Memphis economy, and yet neither is a technology business, although they both rely on technology for some of their success. Talk to me about why technology in Memphis, Tennessee.
There's a much broader vision and infrastructure that goes into creating an idea such as FedEx or AutoZone, and those are more fundamentally steer away from traditional challenges of retail. I think the successes that FedEx has seen have been a result of realizing the idea. I mean, the data around a package is more important than the package itself. But maybe the word technology is maybe too limiting to think about it. Maybe it's more the idea of true innovations in business that actually can create that high growth and high impact. And that's why exactly where I think that FedEx and AutoZone have focused in on. For ourselves, while we say technology, I think that it becomes more synonymous with innovation. We certainly help as many people that are trying to open up retail shops here locally. But for us, it's really about the future thinking and the new paradigms that are going to transcend barriers and really have a really, really big impact.
What does a city need to have a successful entrepreneurial economy?
It goes beyond capital. And, you know, besides capital, what else do you need? I think that you would need entrepreneurs on an internal basis need to be able to think about good ideas, amass knowledge around them, and then execute externally the things that we can influence as community members. are leveraging world-class research institutions, providing training and skill sets, and providing that connectivity to capital and easing them through a pipeline where they can actually fail fast. Those are the types of things that we can facilitate and do for them. And that's what you see in Silicon Valley and Research Triangle Park and Boston, and those infrastructures that are sitting there.
There are a lot of communities, though, and I would suggest that Memphis is one of them, that doesn't have ready access to world-class R&D, world-class research and development. So how do you plug that missing piece?
You know, at Memphis, we've done a good job of finding our niche opportunities that are world-class that we can stand on, particularly the biomedical device and orthopedic device manufacturers here is a major area of strength. You would see supply chain and logistics as also a major area of strength in our position. So building upon those particular industries, we can compete on a world-class basis. And so that's what a lot of the infrastructures have been focusing on, from our BioWorks Foundation to the FedEx Institute of Technology.
If you were Memphis has a pretty good history of risk-taking. I think it goes back to riverboat gamblers or something. There's something in the culture there that encourages risk-taking. There's not a lot of big venture capital money, but there's a whole lot of private small dollars for risk-taking and a pretty good tolerance for risk, it seems. But I'm wondering if you were starting with sort of no sense of that. And there are some cities that really just have no culture of risk-taking. What do you do to get it? How do you start to seed that and then supercharge it?
Yeah, I think there's good models that are starting to emerge. I mean, Memphis, we've been on this path before we even launched Memphis began. This has been a five or 10-year journey already. Started a little bit from starting a little bit of incubators. Now we've got a little bit of seed fund. But if you really wanted to try to kind of jump and really supercharge things and move things forward faster, you got to look to programs that are occurring, such as in Detroit, where they're investing $1 million a year in very early stage, seed stage development of entrepreneurial ventures. And in those programs, they're just forming teams, moving them through, and helping them fail as fast as possible, and then getting them back into the system. And when you can supercharge that using $5 million a year, that's a tremendous way to actually leverage a lot of power. In Memphis, we haven't been as fortunate in that regard. It has emerged from various sectors and groups to try to create an infrastructure that's more unified. But if you wanted to supercharge it, you certainly could. But it would certainly take a concerted effort of providing the right infrastructures right from the beginning and providing the incentives and dollars there to actually get the teams formed and move forward as quickly as possible.
So you think it's more a question, Eric, of money?
Looking at accelerating something rapidly as possible, money helps. Money certainly helps. I'm not saying that money solves all those problems, because again, besides capital, there is a whole other components that need to be there. In Memphis, we've started out by focusing on deal flows and the teams themselves and emerging ideas and supporting them and getting them connected to capital and to each other and collaboration. Now, what we do lack in Memphis is some very early stage, high risk dollar amounts. And there's maybe a handful of areas where you can actually get that type of money. In fact, even those are having a hard time sustaining that. And so I think it does take, if you want to try to accelerate things faster, and that's kind of where we're at in Memphis, we need to kind of see those early stage, seed stage dollars. And thankfully, as a result of the local community, the Memphis CD plan, the economic development plan, there is at least a seed fund that's begun, and now a focus on building an angel network, which hasn't been in Memphis for about a decade or so.
Mm-hmm. What sort of persons make good angel investors? What's the type?
Preferably, it's those that have actually been in the trenches and done the hard work and started out right where our entrepreneurs at are in our community. They had a raw idea, and they had to take it through all steps of the business development process and then actually had that success. And then, in return, after whatever 10-year period, go back into the community and say, all right, this is how it's done. I'm getting back into the mix. I want to bring other people with me. And in fact, actually, you can look at the kind of the family tree of success stories that emerged from, all right, HCA had these executives in it, these founders, et cetera, and these have fragmented off and created other opportunities from the human capital that was amassed there. And goes from there. And so to complete the entrepreneurial cycle, you actually have to complete the loop by having the entrepreneurs that had succeeded being visible and reaching back into the community. And that's where you get the vibrance and kind of the powerful effects that you have for a true vibrant economy.
I want to ask you a question. You brought up HCA and you brought up the spinoffs that can derive from any company like an HCA. Does the presence of the founders of great companies like FedEx and AutoZone, I mentioned them earlier, still in Memphis, still working, influence the entrepreneurial culture there at all?
You don't see quite the same chain and the same development that you saw as a result of HCA and Silicon Valley. And I think that goes back to this culture of risk and trying to ensure people know that they can take risks and exit out of a business like FedEx and take a chance. You'd be surprised by how many people I encounter that have an interest in entrepreneurship but are afraid to take that risk. And we're trying to, at least right now, over this two-year period, trying to, get again, amass those teams and saying, hey, it's okay to take a risk. You're employable today. You'll be employable if this thing fails in, you know, 2-3 years.
Is that the fear people have, that if they fail, they won't be employable? What's the fear factor?
Partly goes back to their employability after a failure. And I also think it goes back to what I call the golden ticket problem. You know, if you're going to try to build a real startup here locally, an entrepreneurial venture, if I am going out and raising money with angels here, or I'm going to talk to Fred Smith, or I'm going to talk with Pitt Hyde, they feel like they only get one shot at it. And that if they make that shot and they fail to get their goal, the end result, which is money, that's it. They're going to be kind of washed up here in our community. And we need them to realize that that's totally not the case. It's okay to reach out. It's okay to fail. And you'll get right back into the system. And there's not a golden ticket out there for entrepreneurship. It's just, you know, perseverance.
You mentioned earlier Emerge Memphis, which was in part an incubator. Incubators at one point, 10 years ago, were very popular, and that was going to be the thing, that was going to be the ticket for cities that wanted to supercharge entrepreneurship and business startups, and especially tech startups. They haven't worked out that well in a lot of places. What's your assessment of the value today of an incubator, a physical incubator space?
I think one of the challenges that incubators of the past have faced is dynamics of the cost of startup actually have changed. Even just a couple years ago, in order to start up, you had to raise a certain amount of money and you had to have a physical office space. But the actual, when you look at the technology industry and internet startups, et cetera, you don't really need that infrastructure anymore. It actually changed what type of clients were attracted to incubators. They didn't really need that type of space. Another issue that I think emerges as a result of that is that there's incubators focused in on companies that actually could take a little bit more of a long-term view and actually could get into a lease and pay at least a small amount to subsidize their presence there. Now we're seeing a movement in the United States in general, not just here in Memphis, for co-working environments. And the reason that those are so popular is because those are risk-oriented spaces. And if incubators could shift into that modality, in fact, actually in Atlanta, we're already seeing this, and in Austin, and even in L.A., there's the development around incubators or in incubators for co-working environments, which are highly risk-oriented spaces. So I think from our standpoint, they just need to shift their business model and realize that they can't get into, you know, longer-term situations. They need to look for the emerging entrepreneurs that don't need a high amount of infrastructure, especially with the virtualization that can occur with cell phones and the internet.
Well, speaking of virtual situations, you aggressively use Twitter and Facebook. I follow you on both. And you use it to promote all sorts of things going on in your home base of Memphis. What is your intent, Eric, with all those tweets and Facebook entries? What are you looking to accomplish?
Well, one of the main principles under which I use these technologies is when I provide people information and knowledge, I empower them to act on behalf of the community, on behalf of themselves, and even on behalf of the organizations that I'm helping to support. I also promote facts about Memphis that are forward-looking and saying, you know, here's where we're doing great here in Memphis, to actually empower the community to think differently and to think about risk and think about attending new functions and activities that are going to help expand their minds, that are more dynamic in nature. And that's kind of the principles under which I'm operating. If I can help people to realize and that there's something new, interesting, a dynamic that can impact their lives and impact the community in a big way, then I think that's a high use of those types of technologies, and you should try to do those. You know, sometimes people look at Twitter and they say, somebody wrote, my cat rolled over. I use these tools to say, you know what, we're changing the community in a positive way.
I think you have great mastery of the tools. I think you do it so well on behalf of your city. And I have to assume that nobody pays you to do this.
Absolutely not, no.
So if I'm a mayor in a city and I don't have an Eric Matthews tweeting about all the cool things going on in my city and posting the same information on his Facebook page, how do I do that? How do I make that happen? Because I think it really is a great way to amplify and magnify what's going on, particularly in mid-sized cities where sometimes there are fewer people and they're more dispersed. Sometimes it's really hard for smart people to find other smart people.
One of the reasons that I'm doing this on behalf of my community is because I'm trying to make my home here. And the reason that is of the connectivity that I've been able to gain as a result of my prior experiences. The FedEx Institute of Technology and starting up my own business and getting Launch Memphis going. And if it wasn't for that type of connectivity and support and actually helping me to identify true needs in our community that came from the nonprofits, the mid-level management at various companies saying, you know, here are some needs in our community and here's how people can connect in and here's people that can support you in doing that, that's what kind of helped engage me as an individual.
Well, clearly, and so I see what you're doing. I want to tell the next mayor how to get this done for his city, or the next Chamber of Commerce president, or, you know, the next person like Peggy McCormick down in Atlanta who runs the Atlanta Development Authority. So how do they find you? You know, how do they find someone like you who's out and about and finding cool things and saying, hey, there's a late night menu, or here's the entertainment, or we're going to meet and talk about entrepreneurship at Republic Coffee. See, I do follow you. And so I'm thinking that is very cool. That's a great way to make people feel like there's a lot going on in Memphis. And you just take what's going on and you're there and you amplify it. And that's what cities need to do. Again, especially mid-sized cities. So give me some advice. I'm a mayor in another city. How do I make this happen?
Partly, it's a process of making sure that people are aware of these tool sets. And we've been doing that through programs here locally, multiple organizations, you know, from Leadership Academy to even Launch Memphis, making sure that people can highlight and amplify the signal above the noise. We connect people in at various levels very effectively as a result of our emerging, actually very strong arts culture now, and providing access to the creative class and making them feel like they're part of the young up-and-coming influencers and providing them, you know, venues. A lot of the concentration on the events is really focusing in on that creative class here locally. I can't tell you how many organizations we've talked about with regard to social media and the creative class and how that convergence there provides a powerful way to amplify a message and also retain interest in the community. I can only speak to it from an individual perspective of saying, you know, here are the tool sets and here's the right connectivity to the right things that are going on. And Memphis has been doing a pretty good job of starting to move down that path. When, you know, these are tool sets that emerge from the coasts, and now, like a city like Memphis, now they're being, you know, more fully embraced and utilized.
But cities can also, just like companies, can use these tools in a very ham-handed way, don't you think?
Yes, they totally can be misused.
Yeah, so how do you get it right? How do you get the tone right?
If you look at my tweets, you have to have an authentic voice, and I think that's what you've latched onto some of my tweets there, and they resonate, is because I'm a person that's looking at the city from a perspective of what the future and the opportunity is, and I'm speaking it from my own vantage point, and that authentic vantage point is better than the mayor saying, hey, go to this type of event. When I speak from where I sit in the community and say, you know what, this is what I think is interesting and cool and going on right now, that type of connectivity creates an accessibility, I guess, in the community. And that's, I think, probably maybe the right recipe there is saying, not only is the city got a lot of great things going on, but it's highly accessible such that, you know, any person of the creative class could participate in the same way that I'm participating.
When you think about the time that you've invested in Launch Memphis and the money that's been invested, as you say, it's not a lot. But in fact, let me ask you, how much has been invested in Launch Memphis?
In 2008, we received $16,000 in cash.
Oh, my gosh. Tell me you've had more money than that.
No, that's 2008. Now, since then, we're going to probably have a little bit larger budget. But, you know, all that budget is going right back into the community. We don't pay, you know, there's no overhead or operational costs associated. They're very, you know, it's like the website is our overhead. So we're really putting that right back into the community. But what's great about Launch Memphis is that for a sponsor, we're a very efficient engine as a result. If you gave us $1 last year, we were able to turn it into $30 in economic impact. So $16,000 turned into $500,000 for our community.
And how are you calculating that?
You can utilize the Tennessee Labor Bureau statistics and the U.S. Department of Commerce statistics and the multipliers associated with that. So when you look at dollar spend, leverage volunteer hours, et cetera, those are the types of tools that you can statistically analyze in a quantifiable way your impact. And many organizations do that. We're trying to elevate our organizations. So that's why we're investing in doing a little bit of time on those types of analyses so that I can prove to our sponsors and others in the community that this is a very worthwhile enterprise and an efficient way to exact change in a community.
Look forward for me with Launch Memphis. What is it in the next year that you would like to accomplish and you could declare it a success?
In the next year, I would like to see a few more businesses that are innovation and technology focused move forward and actually get started and actually receive funding. Right now, during early stages, I don't think many of our businesses have received actual venture funding or angel funding. And so I think that's the next big step for us to take, not only at Launch Memphis, but as a community. And that kind of can move us to the next step toward that entrepreneurial ecosystem. It's a long road. Again, we got to have multiple deals moving forward because many of them will fail. But eventually, hopefully in 5 to 10 years, we will see that success where the entrepreneurs have succeeded coming back into our community and reinvesting their time and energy and kind of creating a loop in the community that will create that vibrance that we're looking for.
Eric, thanks for what you're doing in Memphis, and thanks for showing other cities the way. I appreciate you being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you for having me.
Eric Matthews is the co-founder of Launch Memphis. To find out about their programs, events, and online community, go to our website, smartcityradio.com. Finally this week, Walker Smith brings us the latest research from the animal kingdom. Our City Views commentator tells us what to do when the economy has gone to the dogs and jealousy makes a monkey out of you.
Recent research has shown that dogs have a sense of fairness. A biologist at the University of Vienna conducted a study in which he taught dogs to respond to a command to shake by lifting their paw up to do so. This turns out to be something that most dogs are happy to do without being rewarded. But in this research, some dogs were rewarded for lifting their paw in response to the command to shake, but dogs in a different group were not rewarded. However, they were allowed to see the other dogs that were being rewarded. Eventually, the dogs who got no rewards quit cooperating. Apparently, dogs will stop doing an activity they are normally quite willing to do if they think they are being treated unfairly. It turns out that this is true of monkeys as well. This same researcher conducted an earlier study in which monkeys were trained to hand a small rock to researchers in exchange for food. Some monkeys got a piece of cucumber as their reward. Others got a grape. Those getting the cucumber, though, became agitated and upset and threw fits when they saw the other monkeys getting the superior reward of grapes for the very same behavior. This research actually parallels similar findings about people. We evaluate our positions in life not in absolute, but in relative terms. We judge our stations in life less in terms of what we have and more in terms of what others have. Even when we are well off by any objective standard, we will be dissatisfied with our situations as long as we see that we have less than others against whom we assess our positions. What matters most to our satisfaction is our relative position in life. This is madness, of course. In fact, as research among dogs and monkeys shows, it's little more than an animal instinct. And surely we are better than that. One of the best ways to curb our appetites for wasteful spending and to boost our sense of well-being is to change our reference group by evaluating ourselves against a different comparison group. This bias towards relative assessments of our material position is the primary reason why Cornell economist Robert Frank has long recommended replacing our income tax with a consumption tax. If spending more extravagantly meant paying higher taxes, people at the top would rein in some of their profligacy, and the rest of us would not view our relative positions as quite so deprived. He believes that this would combat our spendthrift luxury fever, the title of one of his books, and a delirium that is clearly one of the root causes of our current financial crisis. A consumption tax is unlikely, of course, but that's okay. With a little discipline, we can help ourselves. The secret is to look around, not look up, when assessing what we have. What we see is that we're actually pretty well off because compared to most others around us, we're in equal or better shape. If we'd just do this, we'd keep shaking hands, content with our piece of cucumber, and we'd actually be happier with ourselves. This is probably a pretty good thing to remember as we sort through what the current recession means to us. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. There's more Smart City waiting for you online. Go to smartcityradio.com to download past shows, sign up for our newsletter, and get links to our guest work. You can also get in touch with us, click on the contact button, or send email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He misses BSG. I'm Carol Coletta.